back. I'm badged as one of the organisers of this conference, so I'd just like to make it very clear that I've done absolutely nothing except when Hugh and Peter emailed the suggestions, I've said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea to me. So now I'm going to discharge some duties as an organiser, partly to thank Hugh, who has in fact done almost all of the work, and Peter, who's done quite a lot more than me, for a really good conference. And also to introduce Hugh, who's telling us about quantum retrocausality of two-year-olds.
Thank you, Helen. And could, while we're on the subject of thanking people, could I just ask you to join me in thanking Stuart, our AV guy up the back there, who, as usual, is doing such a wonderful job. I'm going to talk from over here so that I can shine laser beams at the screen. At least I will if I can find a spot which doesn't cause too much feedback. Let me try this. Otherwise, I can't read what's up there. Well, this doesn't work very well because now I can't see. Let's experiment over here. I should first say that I've now realized as a result of hearing Alison's talk this morning that my title is misleading. It should probably say quantum retrocausality for four-year-olds. But I just stole the two-year-old bit from her title. The other way I think I could fix it is maybe by putting disembodied hands into some of the pictures. It might have the same effect. But there's a sort of deeper worry raised by her talk this morning, which I'll come to as I go along. Okay, let's start with a little bit of physics. So this is classical physics to start with. This diagram here, that's supposed to represent a beam of polarized light, something like, I guess, something rather like this laser beam that I'm using to point to it with. And this thing is supposed to represent what's called a polarizing crystal. Now, a polarizing crystal is something that does exactly the same as the polarizing lens in your sunglasses, except instead of absorbing some of the light, it reflects some of the light. So some of the light goes through it and some gets reflected. And the amount that goes through it and the amount that gets reflected depends on the relationship between the angle of the crystal, just like changing the angle of your sunglasses will change the amount of polarized light that goes through them. So with these crystals, see that's supposed to represent the light that's going through the crystal, coming out that way, and that's supposed to represent the light that's getting reflected. And that represents the angle at which the crystal is set. That represents the angle at which the beam is polarized. And if you don't know what polarization is, don't worry, neither do I really. I mean, you can think of this as just a kind of toy model, which actually happens to be a real world model. Okay, and then there's an expression which is known as Malus's law, which tells us the intensity of the two beams coming out, the transmission beam and the reflection beam, in terms of the angle between the polarization of the beam and the angle at which the polarizing crystal is set. And the rule is that a proportion cos squared of the light comes out through the transmission beam and a proportion sine squared goes the other way. And those two things, of course, add up to one, which means that all of the light goes somewhere, all of the energy goes somewhere. Part of it goes that way, part of it goes that way. Okay, now, the classical theory of this sort of stuff is time symmetric, so in principle you can do the same thing in reverse. You can now feed two light beams into one of these crystals, and as long as you set things up in the right way, I mean, you have to coordinate what's called their phase. But let's not worry about that. It's not going to play any role. As long as you set it up in the right way, you can get a single beam to come out whose polarization is, again, given by what are effectively the same expressions. So if you feed this beam in with intensity, with that intensity, feed this one in with that intensity, then the beam will come out with that polarization. So as I said before, this is I mean, you can kind of derive this immediately from the fact that the theory is time symmetric. So whatever it shows in one direction of time, it also has to show in the other direction of time. And you can think of the two pictures as being related just by flipping the direction of time. Okay, and so once you know that you can do these two kinds of experiments, then of course you can put them together like this. And there's just a couple of comments I'd like to make about this before we move on. One is that one way to think about this, I mean, one of the things I want to emphasize is that you could use this, you could make this piece of physics the basis of something like one of Alison's little, the kind of little toys that Alison and her collaborators give to kids. So you could set this up in some kind of variation of a, what's it called, a Blickett detector, where you have some kind of little you have some sort of little control on the box which lets you play with the angle of the polarizer here and here, and you have light beams coming in, and you can see what the effect of wiggling one or wiggling the other is on the light beams coming out at the end. Okay, so that's one thing I want to point out about these cases. Another thing I want to point out, and this is something that I now have some hesitation about as a result of something that Alison said this morning, is that one way to think of the role of the idea that the beam has a polarization at that point is to think of it as just what you need if you think that there must be a mechanism involved. So if you set this thing up, you can find out by wiggling this, as long as you have a certain amount of control over this input. I mean, suppose you fire a beam in here, you wiggle that, what's going to happen is that the amount of light going that way and going that way is going to change. Now, in physical terms, we'd say that the reason is that with a fixed input from here, wiggling this is affecting the polarization, and that in turn is affecting how much light is going that way and that way. So, but one way to think of this property, the beam in the middle, is as precisely what must be there in order for there to be some mechanism which connects the wiggles you can make on the left-hand side when you decide how to set the angle of the polarizer with what happens on the right-hand side. Now, in a sense, in this classical case we're talking about, that the sense in which that doesn't matter very much, because you can look inside the apparatus and you can see the beam. So there's another way of thinking about it. But you can also think of the role it's playing in the argument as this kind of intuitive role of being something which connects the wiggle over here with what happens over there. Now, what I'd be wanting to say at this point is that we have a kind of natural kind of intuition which can be demonstrated in children to think that there must be a mechanism. And some of Alison's comments this morning made me realize that that's a far more controversial claim than I was thinking. But we can come back to that point in the context of the quantum version of this, where the question of the status of the stuff in between is much more controversial. Okay, so, well, I've already made some comments about thinking about these things in terms of what we can wiggle. Okay, so So what I want to say next is another question that we can think about in terms of our intuitive ideas of wiggling and control and so on. So let's think about this. Apparatus again, and let's imagine that we've got knobs on these two on these two pieces of apparatus, which actually control the angle of the polarizer. And now, first of all, let's think about the one on the left. And the question I want to ask you to think about is, suppose you control this, you control the angle of this polarizer, but you don't control the input beams. Suppose those input beams are under the control of the creature I'll call the demon of the left. whose interest is really in frustrating the control that you might otherwise have over other aspects of the system. So the question is, can you control the polarization of this output beam, the one coming out of your experiment? Can you control its polarization by controlling the setting on the cube here? So you can control this. You can control sigma L. Can you use that element of control, your ability to wiggle that, to control this in this special circumstance where the input beams are not fixed, but under the control of the demon who is trying to frustrate you? And the answer turns out to be no, and it's fairly easy to see why that's the case. So the demon can make the polarization of this beam whatever she likes by choosing the appropriate input intensities in the light of your choice for the polarization here. So whatever change you make here, the demon can make a corresponding change to the input beams, which will keep the polarization the same. So just think about that. One of the things I'm trying to emphasize here is how much the causal thinking, which is going into thinking about what you can do here, is just the same kind of causal thinking which is involved in very simple everyday examples. The kinds of causal thinking which Alison and her collaborators are eliciting from small children. Now, in ordinary sorts of circumstances, we don't deal with anything like this demon at the left. But the question I want to focus on, and we'll come in a moment to why I think that's an important question, the question is what do we do if there is such a demon? And the answer is we can do nothing. We can do nothing in terms of controlling that polarization by manipulating the setting of the polarizing crystal on the left there. Okay. Now let's think about what that means on the right-hand side of the experiment. Suppose now that instead of wiggling the angle on this side, you're now in the position of wiggling the angle on that side. What we're now interested in is the question whether by wiggling this angle, you can control the polarization of this beam. And obviously it seems to us, no, of course not. That would be some kind of crazy retrocausality. Why is it you can't do that? Well, intuitively, because when you make a wiggle here, the differences as a result of that wiggle, what else wiggles when you wiggle the setting of this polarizer? That doesn't change. What happens is that the intensities of the two output beams change. So you can kind of wiggle the intensities of the two output beams. So in a sense, nature is absorbing all the difference that due to your wiggle in the difference of the intensity of the output beams, and none of it is showing up here in the polarization of the beam between the two experiments. And I hope you can see that that's exactly analogous, just flipping left to right, to what was happening on the left-hand side when the demon was absorbing all the effect of your wiggle by changing the intensity of the input beams, so that in the case I was talking about before, your wiggles over here were having no effect on the polarization of this beam. Okay, so this is what I've already said. You can't control the polarization of the input beam by wiggling here because nature is absorbing the wiggles in the output intensities, and the polarization here isn't changing. So as we'd intuitively expect, there's no retrocausality. Okay, so that's what happens in classical physics. I now want to apply the same kind of intuitive causal reasoning to think about the description of this case that you get in quantum mechanics. So now we want to move on to the third topic, which is quantum polarization. And in many ways, this is exactly the same. The big difference is that instead of a beam of light, we can now think about individual photons. Because one of the great lessons of the quantum revolution is that things like light are quantized, as people say. That is, there's some sense in which they can be thought of as coming in individual packets of energy, which in the case of light we call photons, which in some respects behave like particles. You can count them, for example. Okay, so in this case, the right-hand case, what we have in quantum mechanics is a kind of quantum analog of the law that we had in the classical case. I'll call it quantum Marlis's law. And really, the only difference is that in place of the expression for the intensities of these two output beams, we now have an expression for the probability that the photon is going to go one way rather than the other. So we're now thinking in terms of there being a single photon in the experiment. It encounters this polarizing crystal. There's a probability that it'll get transmitted and go that way, and there's a probability that it'll go that way. And those two probabilities, again, depend on the difference in the angle between the polarization of the photon and the polarization of the polarizing crystal here. And the expressions are just the same as in the case of the classical case. So there's a cos squared of the difference between the angles, probability that it'll go that way, a sine squared probability that it will go that way. And once again, this is basically time symmetric, at least the sort of the quantum theory on which this depends is time symmetric. So you can do the same thing in principle on the left-hand side here. In this case, you have to be a little bit careful about what you mean by these probability expressions, because in some sense they're probabilities for something in the past, and there are some tricky issues there which you can kind of get round, but it involves a detour which I don't want to go into for the purposes of the talk, that we could come back to it if anybody wants to bring it up in discussion. But again, it's basically the same expressions. So now let's think about these issues about connection and control in the context of this combined experiment where we just put those two left and right experiments together. One thing to say about this is that in this case, the status of the idea that the photon has these properties, which I'm here writing as tau L and tau R for left and right. Now, in sort of standard presentations of this, nobody would write two properties there for a start, and I'll come in a moment to why, given what I want to say about it, it's important to have two of them. Let's just focus on the one which people would ordinarily talk about, which is what I'm calling the tau L or the left polarization. The job that it's doing, I mean, this is not something that you can't look inside the experiment to see if there's a photon in there. So the job it's doing is, intuitively, it's the job of providing a kind of mechanism whereby wiggles that you can make here can have a difference over here. And again, you can set it up so if you set things up so that all the photons are coming this way, you've got a substantial number of them, then wiggles here will show up in terms of differences in the number of photons coming out this way and coming out that way. So intuitively, it would be the case that wiggling here is associated with making a difference over here. And again, the sort of mechanistic intuition, the intuition that we don't have causal connections between distant systems, leads us, or at least some of us at any rate, to think that there must be some kind of mechanism connecting the two. And for these purposes, this polarization here is just that mechanism, whatever it is. Now, we'll come back to that later on and consider what we can do by giving up that intuition. But for the moment, I'd like to ask you to kind of follow me in giving into the intuition that if by wiggling this we can make a difference over here, then there has to be some kind of connection in virtue of which that's so. Some kind of connection in particular which, so to speak, carries the information about what's been done over here over to this side. And that's what tau L is, the left polarization. Okay, now let's think again about what we can wiggle and what we can control in the way that we did in the classical case. So again, as in the classical case, let's suppose that we can control the left polarizer here, but we don't control the input photons. The demon on the left controls those. Question: can we control this left polarization, tau L? Answer: yes. Remember, in the classical case, the answer was no. The demon could defeat. The demon could counteract any effect of our wiggles by making an appropriate change to the intensities of the input beams. But in this case, as long as the demon operates under the restriction that she has to put the photon on one channel or the other, in other words, she has to send it in this way or send it in that way, and again, we'll come back to that a bit later on, as long as the demon operates under that restriction, then it turns out that if you choose to set this polarizer to that angle, sigma L, then there are only two possibilities for tau L. It has to be either the same, or it has to be the same plus 90 degrees, which is what that means. So in this case, as long as the demon is operating under that restriction, you don't have complete control over this polarization, but you have a hell of a lot more control over it than you do in the classical case. You can fix it down to two possibilities, and the choice between those two possibilities is then up to the demon. So as I say, you can't fix it completely, but you can restrict it to just two possibilities. So at least under this restriction on what the demon can do, quantum mechanics allows you to do something with the polarization of the photon that you couldn't do with the polarization of the beam in the classical case. And what's really interesting about that is what it implies on the other side. So now let's turn to on the other side. Remember, in the classical case, the natural way to think about it was that any change you made here just showed up. I mean, what nature did in response to wiggling here was make a change to the intensity of the output beams so that none of the wiggle showed up retrocausally in a difference in the polarization of the input beam. But here, now let's suppose again that you don't control the output beams, nature controls those. Question: can you control the polarization of the input beam? I'll now talk about tau R, and I'll say something in a minute about why I'm distinguishing that from tau L. And the answer again, and this really just follows by symmetry from the previous case, is that as long as nature has to put the photon on one channel or the other, as long as the photon has to definitely go this way or definitely go that way, then in this case, the only possible values for tau R are sigma R or sigma R plus pi on 2. So again, you can't fix tau R completely, but you can restrict it to just two possibilities by choosing sigma R. And that's retrocausality. Okay, now that's, I hope that looks very surprising, and I now want to say something about the kind of assumptions which have gone into it. I already mentioned the assumptions about there being some kind of mechanism which connects the wiggles you make over here to differences over here. And I said that's in effect, that's what this little piece of reality here depicted by tau L is. It's whatever the piece of mechanism is which does the job of connecting those two. Okay. Now here's a hidden assumption that I didn't flag. It's the assumption that whatever the story about the mechanism in this kind of system, it's time symmetric. So that if there's a piece of mechanism which depends on this end, there's also a piece of mechanism which depends on that end, in so that if you flip the whole thing round in time, as it were, you wouldn't change anything. So what's tau R? It's just what you have to have in the picture if your intuitions about mechanism commit you to there being something real tau L, requiring that the mechanism be time symmetric commits you to tau R2. Why is that an additional commitment? Well, because there's this control here, these two things can't be the same. They can't be just two different, they can't be two ways of talking about the same piece of reality. And that's because, given that they're dependent on these things in this way, it's easy to set things up so that those two things have to be different. They have to have different values. So if you choose an angle here, which requires that this be, so this angle here requires that tau L be either that or that plus 90 degrees, almost any choice you make here is going to be incompatible with that being the same as that, given this kind of constraint that we've just kind of unearthed. Okay, so that's one thing I wanted to say. There are sort of two intuitions which are driving this. One is the intuition that there's a kind of mechanism connecting these two things. The other is the requirement that mechanism be time symmetric. Now, I think it's probably true to say that last assumption, the assumption of time symmetry, is something that 2-year-olds and 5-year-olds are not going to, and that's not going to be part of their natural repertoire. On the other hand, there's a deep sense in which it is these days part of the natural repertoire of physicists. Physics going back now for several hundred years has turned out to be deeply time symmetric. So many physicists would think it would be deeply strange if the fundamental theory had to be time asymmetric. So time symmetry is quite a powerful intuitive constraint for physicists, if not for 2-year-olds or 4-year-olds. But still, apart from that additional input, which, as I say, ought to seem like a plausible one for most physicists, the kind of reasoning that's involved here is just intuitive causal reasoning. That's, in a sense, the point I wanted to make in this context. Okay. I think I've said most of this already. So it's the assumption of time symmetry which gets us from the assumption that there's a property to be labeled tau L to the idea that there must be also a property we can label as TR. Now there's one more crucial assumption which I haven't kind of flagged yet, and it's the assumption that I'll call discreteness. If nature has the option over here of, in some sense, spreading the photon out, so part of it goes one way and part of it goes the other way, then we're back to exactly the classical case. In that case, nature has the ability to absorb any wiggle we make here in a difference in the, what we might call the proportion of the photon that goes that way and the proportion that goes that way. In that case, it's exactly like in the classical case, where the fact that the energy could be distributed in any proportion between the two output beams was what gave nature the flexibility. So if you have something corresponding to that in the underlying ontology for quantum mechanics, then this implication goes away. And there are certainly some ways of understanding the quantum world in which that's true. There have to be ways which make it true even in those cases in which we make a measurement. I mean, it's well known that if we make a measurement to look to see which way the photon goes out, we'll find it on one channel or on the other channel, but never on both. So this is the fact that's sometimes described as saying that measurement in quantum mechanics collapses the wave packet. It kind of takes us from a situation of kind of mere probabilities and potentialities to a situation in which we have one fixed outcome. And there's nothing to stop us as experimenters on this side setting up measuring devices so that in measurement terms, the photon does definitely come out one way or the other. So we can give nature a helping hand in that sense. So in order to defeat this argument for retrocausality, you have to say that even in those circumstances in which we give nature a helping hand by making a measurement over here, there's still some sense in which the photon is going both ways. Now, there are views of quantum mechanics according to which that's true. One is the so-called many worlds interpretation, in which the real reality is just the wave function which just evolves. And the idea that we get a definite measurement is just a kind of fact that we're looking at things from one particular perspective. So in reality, as it were, there's no definite result. And then there are other views which also have that kind of consequence. But in any view in which, at least if we make a measurement, there's definitely a fact of the matter as to which way the photon goes, and kind of no other ontology in the picture where we can put the continuity. So in any picture of quantum reality in which that the discreteness can be made sort of ultimate in that sense, then the argument as we had it before applies. And if in those cases, the only way you can escape from the retrocausality is, well, there's basically two ways. You can give up on the time symmetry, or you can give up on the idea of a mechanism. So you can say, let's take the second one first. You can say, well, really, in reality, there's nothing between these measurement devices. And some people think that. Some people think that the lesson of the quantum world is that we should be sort of instrumentalists. We shouldn't be asking the question, what happens between measurements? So there's that deeply sort of anti-realist strand in one way of looking at quantum mechanics. And people who are happy with that way of looking at things are not going to be moved by this kind of argument. People who aren't happy with that way of looking at things and who have a picture whereby it is a fact of the matter which way the photon comes out, at least if we make a measurement. The only option for them for avoiding this conclusion, as far as I can see, is to give up on time symmetry. And as I mentioned before, that's an option which most contemporary physicists would find deeply unattractive. Okay, so what's interesting about this case, I think, there are really two things. One is what we get for sure, and that's a kind of demonstration of how the simple intuitive ideas at the basis of ordinary causal reasoning, namely ideas of mechanistic connection and wiggles, can lead us to postulate retrocausality given an appropriate set of kind of data. So one of the things I wanted to show is how creatures like Alison's four-year-olds, if not two-year-olds, could be naturally be led to a retrocausal picture of what's going on in some circumstances. Given that their world turned out to be a certain way. And I think that's one of the things that this kind of example illustrates. And what we certainly don't get for sure, but maybe get motivated by that kind of thought, is a simple intuitive answer to some of the deepest quantum puzzles. And what I really wanted to do was to bring those two kinds of ideas together in the way that I think this example enables us to do. Okay, that's it.
Process P were repeated an infinite number of times and I controlled it each time, then I controlled the probability, the end results coming. And it seems like if I'm sure that's false in this case, as where if nature hasn't disabled, imagine the ontology is straightforward, and the proton has to go one way or the other, but this experiment is repeated an infinite number of times. Nature can, as it were, decide, even though she can't decide on any given occasion what it is, she can.
I think if that goes anywhere, it's only by denying some of the intuition about mechanism. Because if you accept that there's a fact in the individual case, and it's the kind of fact that you need in the individual case in order to explain the kind of control that you can do from this side to that side, and you accept that it's time symmetric, then what you get is that it's true that but this is what I admitted anyway, by controlling this, you can't control, so you can't, on a particular occasion, you can't make it the case that tau r is sigma r rather than sigma r plus 90 degrees. Nature has as much control over that as she wants. But that's where all the probability is going to go. It's still going to be a feature of the case that by choosing sigma r there, you make it the case that nature's options here are only sigma r and sigma r plus 90 degrees.
But I was thinking she has, in any given case, she has two options. She's limited to two options.
Yeah.
And using those two options over an infinite number of trials and selecting them in an intelligent manner, she can set the probability wherever she wants.
In order for that to be any kind of answer to this kind of argument, it has to be an answer which will work on the other side as well. So it has to be an argument kind of against mechanism, or at least the sort of watering down mechanism, in such a way that it's no longer true from the left, as it were. That so it has to be an argument which gives us a reason to think of tau L not as being a property of the individual photons, but in some sense a property only of a class of them. And so there are strategies like that, and some of the instrumentalist ones are in effect going in that direction. People say, for example, you probably know that, you know, quantum mechanics doesn't talk about individual systems, it only talks about ensembles. And that's a rather hand-waving way of saying something which might lead in the direction you're talking about. So it's possible that something will do something like that, will provide a way of kind of countering the mechanistic intuitions. But if so, I think it's via that route, which I've already identified, not via showing that there's some hole in the argument.
There's a couple of other assumptions that seem to have snuck in there. One of them might be trivial, but I don't know, you can tell me. The other one's a bit more of a worry. The first one is that on your very first slide, you spoke about the intensity of the beam going across between two objects. And suddenly then you skipped across and started talking about polarization and not intensity. So
no,
that means that there's a bit of a change somewhere between intensity and polarization. I'm not sure they're the same thing.
I didn't mean to claim that they were the same thing.
You go back to the beginning, or you go back to the classical bit, and you were talking about...
So let's go back.
On there and you say it's intensity is this.
Yeah, but
then later you say the polarization is that.
No, so this is Marlis's law. A Marlis's law is it gives us expressions for the intensities of these beams in terms of the polarization. I mean, think of these things as proportions. Think of these as being an expression which tells you the proportion of the energy which goes out on one channel or the other. So it's not an absolute intensity, it's a proportion, first of all. And that proportion depends on the relationship between the polarization of the beam and the setting of the polarizer. Okay, but so this thing, tau r, denotes the polarization of the beam. It doesn't denote an intensity. And the beam will have some absolute intensity, which I haven't mentioned, but as long as we think of these things as being just kind of proportions, we don't need the absolute intensity plays no role in this.
Okay.
So it may be misleading, it may be that by using the expression intensity rather than something like, you know, normalized intensity or something like that, it's been a bit misleading.
Okay. makes it. All right, anyway, that's a trivial one. The slightly more worrying one that I have is that there's an assumption there also of identity or hexaity, as it's sometimes called. There's an assumption that the photon that comes out is the same as the photon that goes in. There may be quite a lot of re-engineering that goes on in each of the polarizing cubes, and that in fact what comes out is some kind of reprocessing of what goes in. And it's not the same photon in any meaningful sense. Stuff that Richard Feynman talks about in QED, I think, would speak to that.
I don't think this argument depends on that. I mean, remember how I stressed that, as it were, the reason for thinking that there is some piece of reality in between is really, or at least it's related to, our kind of mechanistic no action except by contact intuitions. And that I think, it doesn't depend on any assumption about preservation of identity. I mean, we could presume we have a picture whereby, you know, we thought there's no enduring thing, there's just a whole series of little things which exist for some tiny fragment of time, bump into the next one, and so on. So we could put in a metaphysics which explicitly cancels the idea that there's any enduring thing which survives through this apparatus. But I don't think that would make any difference to the argument.
Just wondering how, say, in the classical model, and in both classical and the quantum mechanical model, where does the demon on the left get its information?
Oh, well, this is just a thought experiment. Oh. So we just imagine that there is a creature. These kind of demons have quite a famous history.
Maxwell's demon in particular.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was about to mention Maxwell's demon too. So the important thing, as you can probably see, the important thing about the demon of the left is that the demon of the left does on the left what we kind of intuitively expect nature to do on the right. And since that's the only role that the demon plays, we can just stipulate that the demon is, think of the demon as God, if you like. You know, the demon's role is a purely formal one, so we don't have to worry about what mechanism makes the demon possible. The demon is impossible, but it makes no difference to this argument.
And with the demons having an effect on the system, on the output.
No, what the demon is really doing is, the demon is what Dennett calls an intuition pump. So the demon is a purely imaginary creature who's telling us something interesting about the right-hand side by thinking about the left-hand side in a certain way and then exploiting the symmetries.
In both cases?
Yeah, in both the classical and the quantum case, yeah.
Jason,
yeah, thanks. Let me check. I'm not sure you want to say that the demon's impossible, just that you don't care whether you can actually make one, but you don't think
I was exaggerating a bit for dialectical purposes.
Stephen may get you.
Yeah.
Is that a finger on this? Or? Oh, okay.
Just wanted to make sure I had the case. So the version where the quantum version where we've got the demon on the left.
Yeah.
You can control the tau bell to some extent. But you can't control R, is that right? Or can you control the probabilities of
that?
No, the not tau R, but R, like which way the photon goes on the right.
In an individual case, I mean, if you assume that's fixed, then by controlling tau L, you control the probabilities over here. So if you're treating everything as fixed except your wiggle here and putting in the demons, so then it turns out that you do have control over the you do have control over these probabilities. Of course, there's a sense in which that's not going to show up in the individual case. But if you had a picture of probability whereby there was a single case probability, then it would be the case that even in the presence of the demon of the left, wiggling here would affect those single case probabilities.
So can you use that as an argument against people who don't want to buy into the whole tower business?
I thought that's where you were going, and that it was helpful. So yeah, if you had an opponent who was a strange kind of opponent, they were a sort of instrumentalist in the quantum case, they said, I don't want to talk about any of that rubbish of what happens between measurements. But they were somehow deeply realist about single case probabilities and prepared to be time symmetric about those. Then, yeah, I think you're right. You could say to them, look, if your kind of metaphysics of probability is time symmetric, then just as this controls that, then I think it's going to be the case. But what I'm worried about is that having those probabilities in their ontology might give them the flexibility that, say, an Evretian or a Bohm theorist has of sort of avoiding the argument altogether. Because, I mean, given the way that the argument does depend on the fact that there isn't some extra piece of ontology in which you can absorb this. So I'm just not clear as to which way. I see the way the thing's going. I just have a slight worry that there might be a trap at the end.
This is just another question, because I'm not sure how this is clarificatory like John's, because I'm not sure I can quite get the case. Is, say I set sigma L to zero.
Yeah.
And so tau L must take one of either two values,
yeah,
depending upon whether the photon went in. L equals 1, L equals 0. And then, lo and behold, the idea of photon emerges from R equals 1, you're saying that we can infer that it must have had tau R at a certain value, because that's what would explain coming out through R equals 1. Is that right? Depending upon whatever we've set.
I think Sigma L doesn't play any role in this, although it might come to play a role if we're doing things John's way. But the way I was thinking of it doing is, well, we first of all show that even in the presence of the demon, Sigma L gives us control over tau L up to the factor of 90 degrees.
Yep.
And then we argue by symmetry that so long as nature obeys the corresponding restriction, the discreteness restriction, then, and if the ontology is time symmetric, then there must be something in the ontology which is correlated with sigma r in the way that sigma l is correlated with, sorry, tau l is correlated with sigma r.
Right.
And it can't be the same thing because they can be different, of course.
Yes. And I take it that if we were to do this sort of experiment repeatedly, this is now getting back to John Mayer's question, the sort of quantity that would explain the frequency with which I see R equals 0 versus R equals 1 is in fact passing through as tau L.
Yeah, it's tau, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, that's why the reason for thinking that there must be a tau R has to be an indirect one. So that the first reason, so it's first, you have a reason to think that there's a tau L, that's the mechanistic intuition, no action except by contact, that kind of thing. And then there's symmetry. Plus the fact that I mean, in the classical case, these two things are the same. But that won't work here. But because of this new dependency.
And just finally, so does that mean similarly, tau R will explain the frequency with which the demon feeds in L equals 1 versus L equals 0 photons over time if I do it 1,000 times?
Well, you could sort of reformulate that. Slightly, and say, well, suppose you had another demon. Suppose you had a demon of the right, and what the demon of the right does is to cooperate with you, and as enable you, as it were, to fix which of the beams the photon goes out on. That's equivalent to what we can normally do, which is to control where the photon comes in here. Because normally we control that, not the demon of the left. But suppose that there's a demon of the right who gives us that control over the output too. Or equivalently, suppose we kind of get it by sampling from a large. So we just look at the cases in which that's true. Yes, so in that case, there's going to be exactly the same correlation between this setting here and where the photon came from over here. So in that sense, you do get control over the daemon. As long as you've got a daemon of the right, you get control over the daemon of the left. Yes, that's good. That's good. Well, at least from a physical, if not necessarily a political point. Well, one reason it doesn't work is because it's so hard to track down what it means. I mean, the source of the ordinary temporal asymmetry of causal influence and counterfactual dependence is such an obscure issue. I find the simple argument an appealing one, and I've tried to appeal to it in a kind of intuitive way in the past, but. And it has two problems. One, the one I just mentioned about the kind of obscurity of the ordinary intuition when there's an asymmetry. And the other is that, and it's sort of related, it's very hard in many cases to be clear whether the asymmetry isn't in some sense coming in because of special initial conditions. And I think it's much harder to make a case that that's happening in the quantum case. The other thing I should say is that there is a sense in which this is not necessarily quantum. I mean, all it's depending on is what I called discreteness, whereas all it's depending on is that, at least on some understandings of quantum mechanics, at least in the present of measurements, nature is restricted to these two options. And if you imagine a classical case in which that's true, so if you imagine a classical case in which all of the energy has to come out on one beam or the other, then you get exactly the same result there too. It's just normally the world doesn't behave like that, whereas on some understandings of what's going on in quantum mechanics, it does. The extra work, well, another way, this is sort of in a sense an alternative answer to Alistair's question as well. Remember how, just looking at the left-hand side of the experiment, we discovered that there was a difference between the classical case and the quantum case. Is on the left-hand side of the experiment, in the classical case, the experimenter has no control over polarization in the presence of the daemon. Whereas in the quantum case on the left-hand side, the experimenter does. So what that shows is that the discreteness condition adds something to whatever's there in the ordinary case. And it's the whole argument is depending on what's added. And that's why I think it provides a more powerful argument than any of those kind of straightforward attempts to appeal to appeal to time symmetry. I mean, because what happens when people like me try to appeal to the simple argument in order to try to use it in support of the idea that there might be retrocausality in quantum mechanics? People say, well, look, classical physics is time symmetric, but we don't think there's any retrocausality there. And then you get into the messy stuff that I was talking about in answer to Alistair as to why we ordinarily think that there's a sort of asymmetry to causation, a temporal asymmetry. Now, I think the answer to that in the end, as you know, I think the answer is that it depends on the asymmetry of a agent's perspective. But that's not going to help at all with quantum mechanics, where the point we want to make in quantum mechanics is that there could be a structure of correlations which we're simply missing because we're wrongly blind to this possibility of retrocausality. And I think the nice thing about this argument is because of the way it distinguishes between the classical and the quantum cases, by sort of pulling out the role of discreteness, it has the ability, under the assumptions I mentioned, to sort of take us somewhere new and sort of highlight the difference that we get in the quantum case, which is always what I was interested in, because I was always interested in arguing that one way of understanding some of the weird things about quantum mechanics is in terms of the idea that there's something new going on there about the structure of correlations. And really, I'd want to say that, you know, down at the fundamental level, that's what the reality is. It's just the patterns of correlation. But there's a particular possibility of other patterns, which most people have been missing.
Yeah.
Just three questions, two which are bootstrap. If we throw in a few holes, fiber optics in between, and we measure it each end, do you have any intuition as to what happens in terms of our ability to see what's coming in and then being delayed through the site slowing?
I'm not exactly sure what you have in mind, but in the quantum case, we're assuming that there's kind of no measurement in between, and as long as the fiber optics is such that that's still true, then for one thing, I don't think it really matters how long the channel between those two devices is. So you know, in principle.
The second one would be identification. If we were to, if there's such a thing as polarizer for electrons, or if we were to impart a spin on one before it comes in and then see if it comes out the same spin.
Well, I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're asking. I mean, I think and also I may be getting to the limits of my simple physics, but my understanding is that the sort of mathematics is here is the same for spin, and so you could run this argument with spin too. But I think what it's true to say is that you don't have a kind of classical analog of spin, so you can't bring out the nice contrast between the classical and the quantum case in the same way.
Our photon is not a photon, but a conscious agent, which is difficult to imagine.
Yeah.
We would imagine that in that case, it's self-measurable as it goes through. We throw a cat through.
I'm trying to answer that a bit obliquely. I mean, I think that I've always thought that one of the attractions about the idea of retrocausality in quantum mechanics was that the restrictions that quantum mechanics places on what it's possible to observe provides a kind of loophole within which the retrocausality can exist without giving rise to kind of paradoxes. Now, asking us to imagine that there's a sort of observer in the system who's in one sense is behaving like a quantum device, in another sense is conscious, is in a sense just not playing the rules of the game, I think, because it's refusing to face up to the restrictions that quantum mechanics places on observation.
That's great.
Peter.
Thank
you.
Oh, right. I'll start again then. So, just one thing you might try and respond to, which is say that there's a couple of suppositions you're making which are inconsistent with one another, and those are that you control the right polarizer, but nature controls the output beam. So maybe those two facts about what controls what just can't be true at the same time.
Are you thinking this is something to say about just the quantum case or the classical case too?
Yeah, classical case too.
In the classical case, and I think it's true in the quantum case too, saying that nature controls the output beam is just a kind of very metaphorical way of saying that there's somewhere where the difference associated with your wiggle can show up other than in the properties of the input beam here. And it's the fact that there's somewhere for the difference to go, so to speak. So think of it like this. You haven't done any wiggling yet. You're contemplating the possibility of wiggling using one of sort of using the kind of resource that Alison was talking about this morning about sort of considering hypothetical interventions. One intervention you could make is to intervene and set that to one particular value. Another intervention you can make is to set to another value. And now you're thinking about, as it were, what corresponding changes to expect elsewhere. And the point is that in the classical case, we expect the corresponding changes to be entirely in the future. And then the whole point of the argument was that in the quantum case, subject to the various assumptions, that can't be true. And so that contemplating the case as agents, we ought to think that some of the antecedents of those, some of the consequences of those hypotheticals concern matters in the past in a way in which they don't in the classical case.
Describe the classical case in the Dean on the left. There was one thing you said that I assumed couldn't be important, but just let me make sure it's not important. The natural way I would have thought to describe it is that the demon chooses first, and then you choose the angle, and that does, depending on other assumption, perhaps give you some control.
Oh yeah, no, that's the normal case. I mean, in the normal case, in the normal case, we think of it as fixed in advance of our choice. Whether or not we control the input, we think of it as fixed. And I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that. All I'm asking you to do is to think about how you would think about it if you knew that the inputs were under the control of this demon who could predict what you were going to do. And maybe this is something I didn't emphasize enough, that you're right, that's very different from the way in which quite probably we normally think about the left-hand side. But it's different for a specific reason, namely that it then makes the left-hand side correspond to the degree of control we have on the right-hand side, where we don't control the outputs. So the whole structure of the argument is to imagine a restriction on our knowledge of the inputs. It's not just our knowledge, it's also the kind of variability in response to wiggles. So imagine that things are different on the left-hand side from the way we ordinarily take them to be, and from the way in which we ordinarily take them to be with good reason. We can apply our ordinary causal thinking to think about that case. And what we find in that strange case is that in the classical case, we don't have any control. The demon deprives us of control over the polarization of the beam in the middle here. It's all highly artificial. It's a thought experiment. But it's a thought experiment which is important because of its implications on the right.
Sure. And now we're using the same language for the right-hand side. So left-hand side, the way we think about it is we choose the angle and then nature responds. Right hand side, same thing. We choose the angle and nature responds.
Yes. Yeah, you can think of it like that. You could use nature instead of the demon on the left. It's just that normally we think that nature doesn't do that. Nature is kind of kind to us on the left. In a way in which she's not kind to us on the right.
I think I heard you say that the demon on the left, the quantum mechanics case, knows in advance to what setting on, what we're going to put on the polarizing.
Yeah, that's true in both the classical and the quantum case.
It knows in advance.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of retrospective. Knows before it's what I do, what's going to happen, and therefore chooses what sort of input to give.
Yeah.
So that's a retrocausality.
Yeah, but it's retrocausality in a place which isn't being claimed to be physically realistic, whereas the other kind of retrocausality that I found later is in a place which is being claimed to be physically realistic.
Quantum property of a cat that obeys similar laws. And I think it's related to two different traditions in quantum mechanics. And you may have been asking from the point of view of one of the traditions, you might want to answer from the point of view of both, or say why you don't like the other one. One tradition is to say, as long as we can have these restrictions on what's measurable, that get rid of most versions of the measurement problem, because you can measure it here or measure it there, and reality might be different, but we don't care. The measurements will be compatible. The other tradition is the Schrödinger's cat tradition, which says, ultimately, we're going to want to be able to treat macroscopic objects, including consciousness observers, as quantum systems. And according to Schrödinger, we shouldn't be happy with a theory that says that those macroscopic conscious systems don't have a well-defined state at every moment.
Well, yeah, but contrary to what Schrödinger thought, I mean, one way that the desire to have a unified theory can lead you is towards Everett. Now,
right.
This doesn't apply if you go that way. I mean, that's one of the motivations for Everett. I mean, I think crudely you could say that you have a choice. You go all the way in one direction towards thinking that, that you know, with Everettians, that, that the wave function is the only reality. Or you can go all the way in the other direction towards thinking that there have to be hidden variables and definite properties all the way down.
Good. Thank you. But that does mean you're putting some constraints on which theories can be correct
theories. I'm not exactly sure what you mean. I'm certainly not claiming that this argument applies to all of them. I mean, I've tried to stress that. And what it depends on is this discreteness thing. So in theories in which there's some extra ontology to absorb, to kind of defeat discreteness, then this argument doesn't work.
Thanks.
So, would part of what you know, would part of what you're saying here be something like that? What the demon on the left tells you is that your intuitions about things like control can be sort of separated from your intuitions about things like time. It seems to me that that's part of what's happening. Part of what's happening there is that you're saying your intuition about what kinds of things can I control and what kinds of things I can't control don't necessarily map onto intuitions about what comes first and what comes after.
Well, I want to, that's the sort of lesson that I want to take out of the end, but I don't think it's not already there when we're talking about the demon on the left. The demon on the left just is a way of, I mean, setting things up on the left so that we can apply our ordinary kind of causal intuitions in the way that we are going to need to apply them on the right to think about the case under the assumption of symmetry. So the whole point of the demon on the left is really to impose the restrictions on the left, which are analogous to the ones that nature is imposing on the right.
But surely the point is that if you think about those restrictions don't depend on time itself. They don't depend on having an asymmetry.
No, I think that's true. And there's a sense in which the symmetry I'm exploiting here is not a sort of past-future symmetry, but a left-right symmetry.
Uh-huh.
And there's another reason why I think the argument is a kind of nice one. But
so it could be a psychological question. What actually is the relationship between our intuitions about control and our intuitions about time is the dream. I don't think we really know the answer to that, right?
I'm not sure if this is what you have in mind, but I think one interesting issue which is at least close to these questions is the question as to why we ordinarily think that there isn't anything like the demon on the left. So why we ordinarily think that nature is kind of cooperative. Perhaps I'm just being slow and this is what you had in mind. So I think you can kind of use the notion of the demon on the left as a way of bringing into focus some issues which are not exactly the ones I was trying to get at, but which are in some way in the same ballpark and are extremely interesting. Like questions like, what is our entitlement to assume that when we're trying to control something in the future by wiggling something now, our efforts are not going to be defeated by nature, in effect, playing the role that the demon on the left is playing here. Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting issue.
Yeah.
So, how do you if we think about the classical experiment just being done in the lab, then as I think it's been said, said quite often now, nature will inevitably supply a demon on the right, but not a demon on the left.
Yeah.
So doesn't that show a time asymmetry, and therefore shouldn't you just accept time asymmetry and therefore not have to accept it?
What are you doing asking me that question?
just so that you can share your response with everybody.
In a sense, this links very nicely with the point which is coming out at the end of my discussion with Alison about the last question. What I was saying then was that one of the questions, not the one I was addressing directly, but one which is kind of highlighted by this comparison between the demon on the left and the contrast between the demon on the left and the way we normally expect nature to behave, is the question as to what is our justification for thinking that nature behaves in the kind of kindly way and not the demonic way. Now, I think that in some way the answer has to do with the special region we live in, which is subject to thermodynamic asymmetry and so on. So it's that, and I think you probably agree about this, it's that kind of macroscopic stuff which is responsible for the fact that our kind of our ordinary environment is kind to us in that way, and which is probably responsible for the very possibility of there being creatures who think of themselves as exercising that kind of control. So that's the way in which my intuitions go, but I can't give you a detailed story.
Thank you very much.